He had doubts that she would get to Parks and Rec on time to pick her daughter up from tennis camp. "Gotta go, Tim. Gotta figure out who killed who." She parked and got out, threaded through the crowd to a line of sawhorses outside the entrance to the mall's central atrium. TV vans were pulling in, the local guys, channels 5 and 7. She figured there were only 3 or 4 dead, not enough to catch the attention of the national cable networks. On the other side of the sawhorses, it was the usual crime scene chaos. Cops milled about, walkie-talkies crackled and bleeped. She didn't recognize any of the uniforms, and after a while she sat on the hood of her 12-year-old Passat to wait. The lot broiled, heat wavering up from soft blacktop, and pretty soon she had to stand again, her buns getting too hot against the steel of the car. All kinds of folks had driven in to see what was happening, or maybe they'd shown up to shop and decided to stick around to see what all the excitement was about. A hot dog truck was parked at a discreet distance, outside a party supply store across the road encircling the mall. Lantern Glass's 8-year-old daughter, Dorothy, had gone vegetarian 3 weeks ago. She didn't want to eat anything that had felt feelings. Lantern Glass had done her best to play along, eating pasta and fruit salad and bean burritos, but the smell of hot dogs was making her feel feelings, and not empathetic ones. She was wandering over to buy herself a lunch to regret when she passed some black girls standing around a sporty little bubblegum-colored ride and heard one of them say, "Okello had a front row seat. EMT is looking at his hand 'cause one of the SWAT stepped on it. SWAT ran right by him, carrying machine guns and everything." That was interesting, but Aisha Lantern Glass kept going. Couldn't eavesdrop without being noticed. The hot dog truck specialized in Asian fusion, and she wound up with a jumbo draped in cabbage and plum sauce. She could tell Dorothy she had cabbage and fruit for lunch, and it wouldn't even be a lie. It would just be leaving out details. She meandered back toward the scrum, but slowed and stopped to chug her dog while standing near the rear bumper of the bubblegum mobile. License plate, "Ooh, yum." 3 girls, a little past high school age, wearing jeans so tight that none of them could fit their cell phones into the back pockets, loitered around the front end. A car like that, it was an Audi. They weren't out of the black and blue. More likely they were from the boulevards north of town, where every house had a driveway of crushed white shells, and usually a fountain with a copper mermaid in it. The girl who'd been talking about the SWAT typed something on her phone, then said to the other two, "Okello is waiting to see if they'll let him get his stuff and change back into his street clothes. He can't stand that boost your game uniform. Taking it off is the best part of his day." "I thought it was the best part of your day," one of the other girls said, and they all had a good, dirty cackle. Lantern Glass saw cameras collecting in front of one of the sawhorses, like pigeons charging a fresh scattering of breadcrumbs, and had to go. She finished her dog in a hurry and squeezed in among the local TV news folk. She was the only print journo in the bunch, the only one who would be using her phone to record whatever was said. She was used to it. The St. Vicente Digest employed 8 full-timers, and 2 of them were on sports, down from a staff of 32 just 10 years before. Some days, as many as 5 articles ran under her byline. Chief Rickles emerged from the mall, trailing a small gang of uniformed officers and someone from the DA, a slim, good-looking Latino in a cowboy hat. Rickles was built like a fire hydrant and wasn't much taller. His blonde hair was so fair that his eyebrows disappeared against his pale Germanic skin. He crossed the tarmac, closing in on the cameras, stopped before them and doffed his baseball cap. Lantern Glass had somehow wound up almost nose to nose with him, but he didn't appear to see her, just gazed at some point in the distance over her left shoulder. "I'm Chief J. Rickles with the St. Vicente Police, and I'll be making a brief statement about the incident that occurred here today. At approximately 10:30 this morning, shortly after the mall opened, shots were fired on the upper level of the Galleria, and 4 were slain in an apparent mass shooting. The perpetrator was taken out by a security guard on the scene before the shooter was able to reach the crowded food court. I speak of a single perpetrator because at this time we only know of the one. The shooter was pronounced dead at the scene at 11:16. The heroic individual who eliminated the threat as it unfolded is in good health but is not prepared to make a statement at this time. He lowered his chin and scratched at his pink scalp, and Lantern Glass was surprised to see the chief struggling against some surge of intense emotion. When he lifted his head, his very blue eyes glittered with joyful tears. On a personal note, two of my grandchildren were at the mall today with their mother, my daughter, riding the carousel in the food court, less than 300 feet from the shooting. They were just three of the many children, moms, and shoppers who may well owe their lives to the selfless action of the man who stepped up to stop the shooting before it could escalate. I was able to express my gratitude to him personally only a few minutes ago. I'm sure I will be just the first of many. I can take a few questions now. Everyone shouted at once, including Lantern Glass herself. The chief was right in front of her, but he still didn't look at her. She wasn't entirely surprised. Rickles and Lantern Glass had a complicated history.
"You said four casualties plus the shooter. How many injured?"
hollered the woman from Channel 5.
"Several people are receiving treatment for shock and minor injuries, both here on the scene and at St. Pacenti Medical."
More shouts.
"No comment at this time."
More hollering.
"Still too early to know."
Lantern Glass was jostled and shoved as microphones were thrust past her. She felt that Rickles was willfully ignoring her, but then she called out something that caused him to jerk his head toward her and fix her with his bright, humorous, affectionate stare.
She had yelled, "Was the alleged shooter known to law enforcement before today? Did he have a criminal record?"
"I never said the shooter was male," he told her.
There was no smile on Rickles' face, but his eyes glittered. He did like saying the unexpected thing in front of the cameras, and maybe he liked, too, that he'd been able to catch Lantern Glass out on making assumptions about the perpetrator of a crime. The crowd around her went bananas. The other reporters loved it. Rickles backed away, raising a hand, palm outward in a gesture of peace, and said that was all for now. As he retreated, someone shouted to ask the names of his grandkids, and he returned to say Merritt and Goldie. Someone asked if he could at least confirm the age and gender of the killer, and he frowned and said,
"Let's keep the focus on the people who died today. They're the ones the media should be thinking about, instead of glorifying the demented acts of the perpetrator to collect easy ratings."
Another roar, they loved that too. Every reporter Lantern Glass knew adored coming in for a bit of public flagellation. Then he was going, turning away from them. Lantern Glass half expected him to be lured back yet again. Chief Rickles was a man who loved to make a statement, enjoyed his role as a public wit, scold, moralist, and legal thinker. In that way, he reminded her a bit of Donald Rumsfeld, who had so clearly delighted in toying with the press and dropping a quotable line. Lantern Glass thought, uncharitably, that Rickles was probably glad his grandchildren had been on the scene, because it gave him the opportunity to play two roles at once, firm enforcer of the law and grateful, relieved family man. But she didn't care if he came back and had some more to say. He wasn't going to share anything else worth knowing. If he answered more questions, it would be to suit his needs, not theirs. And besides, a flicker of pink had caught her attention, moving through her peripheral vision. When she stood on her toes and craned her neck, she saw the girls in the bubblegum-colored cars zipping away, not onto the highway, but around the corner of the mall and out of sight. Lantern Glass went after them. 2:11 p.m. The northeastern face of the mall was a long stretch of windowless, sandstone brick, featureless doors painted dull brown, and loading docks. No one entered on this side except employees. The lot was narrow and faced a 12-foot-high chain-link fence with overgrown weeds on the other side. Such places set Lantern Glass on edge. They made her think of the day she'd watched a 24-year-old cop named Reb put 6 bullets in Colson Withers. A pair of police cruisers bracketed the lot, one at either end. Lantern glass slowed down for a big, smooth-faced cop in mirrored sunglasses. He stood in her way until she eased to a stop, and then he walked around to the driver's side window and made a lazy, circular gesture with one hand to indicate she should roll down the glass.
"Family of the employees only, ma'am. You family?"
"Yes, sir," she lied. "My son, Okello. He works at Booster Game. He was in the building when it happened. I'm with those girls you just let through." She pointed to Oo Yum, which was just sliding into a space a third of the way down the lot. But he had stopped listening as soon as she had said a name, just waved his hand, stepped aside. When she pulled into a spot, the 3 girls had already spilled out of their strawberry milkshake-colored Audi, and the driver was standing on her tiptoes, hugging a gangly black kid. A thin crowd lingered among the cars. Employees who'd been evacuated from the building and who were hanging around, high in excitement, telling and retelling the stories of their own narrow escapes. Perhaps because she was remembering Colson, who'd been so at home on a stage, the busy, cheerful swarm of onlookers reminded her of being backstage after a successful performance. A good bloody tragedy, perhaps. She parked and got out, just as the boy and his girl broke their embrace. She intercepted them as they walked back toward the pink car. "You in there when it happened?" she asked the boy without any preamble, her phone already out to record. "I'd love to hear about it." The kid slowed, a thought line appearing between his eyebrows. He wasn't just black, but black, black, like a lava sand beach. Light disappeared into him. Good-looking, of course, but then you had to be to get hired at Booster Game. Youth, health, and blackness were a lot of what they sold to a mostly white suburban clientele. He was still wearing the store uniform. Apparently the cops hadn't let him change.
"Yeah, I was in there. I was the closest person to the action who didn't get shot, not counting Mr. Kellaway."
The 3 girls eyed Lantern Glass with a mix of wariness and curiosity. The girlfriend, the prettiest of them, snub nose, slim neck, and bobbed, straightened hair, said,
"Why you asking?"
"I'm with the paper, St. Vicente Digest. I'd love to know what it was like to be 3 steps away from a bullet. The inside story, how you made it out," she said, answering the girl but looking at the boy while she spoke.
"My picture in the paper?" he asked.
"You bet. People will be asking you for your autograph."
He grinned, but the girlfriend said, "It's $100, and stepped in front of him as if to physically block Lantern Glass from getting any closer.
"If I had $100 in my purse, I could afford a babysitter, but I can't, which means I've only got about a half an hour before I have to pick my girl up from town summer camp."
"Shit,"
his girl said.
"You want to know his story? You can watch all about it on Dateline. I bet they're good for a grand."
Lantern Glass figured a girl with a brand new pink Audi probably had a higher limit on her credit card than she did. She thought the girlfriend was bringing up money as a pose, a bit of spontaneous performance art. Maybe the boyfriend was from the black and blue and the girlfriend was from the boulevards, and now she was trying to impress him by acting like she was street.
"I'm not sure Dateline will be calling," Lantern Glass said. "But if they do, don't you want them to talk to your guy instead of one of 100 other people who were in the mall today? The person who gets their story out first is usually the only person who gets their story out. Besides," and now she fixed the girlfriend with a direct stare, "I'd really like to talk to both of you. I'd like to know how you felt when you heard about the shooting. Knowing your boyfriend was in the building, not knowing if you'd ever see him again."
That softened her. She glanced at her boy, Okello, who had not said anything about money, and who attended to Lantern Glass with calm interest.
"I'll tell you what happened," he said. "You don't have to pay me."
"Can I record you?" Lantern Glass asked, gesturing with her smartphone.
He nodded.
What's your name?
She asked because it was a good place to start, even if she already knew the answer.
Othello Fisher, like Othello, but with a K.
In Aisha Lanternglass's mind, Coulson died again. He died 3 or 4 times every day, even now, face down in his own blood. If he had not bled to death, he might have drowned in it.
What kind of name is Othello?
Lanternglass asked.
He rolled his shoulders in an easy shrug. My mom's big into African history. She made me a cake with num-num berries for my 10th birthday. Bought me a tribal drum. I'm like, damn, what's wrong with chocolate cake and PlayStation?
She liked him already, knew he was going to give her good quotes. The girl's name was Sarah. To keep everyone happy, Aisha got the friends' names too, Katie and Madison, boulevard names, all three.
When's the first you knew something was wrong?
Probably when I saw the gun, he told her.
You saw the shooter?
Mall only opened a few minutes before. I went up to the food court to grab frappuccinos for Irving and myself. Irving and I have the morning at BYG. I don't know why he works there. His family is pretty well off. I guess his mom wants him to experience what it's like to have a job.
Doubt flickered in his big sensitive eyes and he said,
You better not print I said that. Irving's cool. They've had me over for dinner.
I won't publish anything you don't want me to publish.
Anyway, there's a hoop in the BYG and we play horse. Loser has to pay for the winner's frappuccino, but the winner has to go get them.
When's the last time you paid for his drink? The girlfriend Sarah asked him with a certain teasing pride.
Irving's okay. I have to pay sometimes. He's not too good from the left side, though, so yeah. Usually he pays and I go get them.
I won't publish you said that either, Lanternglass promised. I don't want to give away your secret winning strategy.
He grinned again and Lanternglass liked him even more. She thought again that he was from the black and blue, not because he sounded street, but because he didn't. He spoke effortlessly, yet with a certain care in his phrasing. Lanternglass was familiar with the impulse to choose words with some precision. It flowed from the anxious certainty that a single verbal slip would make you sound like you slung drugs on the corner. Lanternglass had spent a year studying journalism in London, doing some of the things Coulson never got to do. And while she was there, she'd read an essay about the English class system. Englishmen, she read, were branded on their tongue. You knew whether someone was posh or trash the moment he opened his mouth and spoke. It was even more true of being black in America. A person would make up his mind about you as soon as you said hello, just from the way you said it. Othello continued,
I was walking back to boost your game when she went by. We passed each other on the big flight of stairs in the central atrium. I was going down and she was going up. I had to look at her twice because she was fooling with something high up on her leg. Like I thought she was messing with a stocking at first, only it was a holster, a thigh holster. She pulled it off just as I went by. She'd been crying, too. Even though she had sunglasses on, I could tell from the mascara streaks under her eyes.
How would you describe her?
Petite, blonde, real pretty. I think her name was Becky.
Or Betty?
No, kind of sure it was Becky.
How do you know her name?
She worked at Devotion Diamonds, same place she shot up. The whole mall has an employee appreciation event on the last Saturday morning of every month before opening. Rog Lewis, he runs the store, gave her an award once, Employee of the Month or something. She killed him first. At least I think that's what happened. He shouted right before the first shot. I know he's dead. I saw them wheel him out.
Go back. She passed you on the stairs. She had a gun. Then what?
I turned to watch her go. I might even have started to walk after her to see if she was... Ow!
His girlfriend had punched him in the shoulder.
You ass! She had a gun, okay?
She hit him a second time. He rubbed his shoulder, and when he spoke again, it was as much to Sarah as to Lantern Glass. I didn't follow too close. She left me behind anyway. After a moment, I began thinking I ought to find someone in security. I had just started back down the steps when I heard Mr. Lewis shout and then a gun popping off. I got down flat on the stairs and froze. Then I heard Mr. Kellaway yelling, "He's the head of mall security," and more shots.
Do you remember how many?
Okello closed one eye, looked into the sky with the other. Three at first. That was when she killed Roger Lewis. About a minute after that, another shot and a sound like something falling over, then a fifth shot, and about 5 minutes later, two more.
You sure about that?
5 whole minutes between the fifth shot and the last two? In a stressful incident, it's pretty easy to lose track of time. He shook his head. 4, 5 minutes. I know, because I was texting with Sarah, so I could see the time on my phone. Lantern Glass nodded, but doubted him. Eyewitnesses reshaped memories into stories very rapidly, and stories were always at least partly make-believe, dramatic interpretations of half-recalled facts. Okello shrugged again. That was it. I stayed put, and a couple minutes later the police charged up the stairs in their armor, carrying machine guns ready to fight off ISIS. Only impact they made was on my hand. One of them stepped on it running by. He paused, then shook his head. You can leave that part out, too. They went in to save lives. For all they knew, they might have been about to face a hail of gunfire. I don't want to put them down. EMTs had a look at my hand while I made a statement. No bones broke.
And you're out, and you're okay, Sarah said, and stretched up on tiptoe to kiss his cheek. And don't you dare say it, or I'm gonna twist your nipple.
Okello grinned, and his lips found hers, and in spite of herself, Lantern Glass decided Ooyum was all right.
Don't say what? Lantern Glass asked.
That he's always okay, Sarah said and rolled her eyes. Him and his stupid dad jokes. I'm even more okay than usual. I mean, I'm not okay. A baby got killed.
A baby?
Lantern Glass asked. His eyelids lowered and a sudden scared, unhappy look crossed his face. Yes, ma'am. Shot with his mom. A woman in a hijab. Her baby, a chubby dude, and Mr. Lewis. Those are the 4 casualties. Everyone who died, not counting the shooter. But you think about some of what's happened in other places, like Aurora and Columbine, and I'm glad it wasn't worse. I'm sure the cops are glad they didn't have to shoot it out with anyone. He laughed then, a harsh, jarring sound that carried no real humor in it. And I bet Mr. Kellaway is glad he finally got to shoot someone. Lantern Glass was thinking she ought to wrap it up, get a couple quotes from the girls she wasn't going to use, and split. If she didn't get moving soon, she'd be late to pick her daughter up from camp. She still recalled keenly the sick and lonesome feeling of being the last to go home, staring out the rain-speckled windows of her modern dance class, wondering if someone, anyone, would turn up to get her. But there was no walking away from that last line, which grabbed her attention and held it.
What do you mean? He's probably glad he finally got to shoot someone.
The almost hungry grin on O'Keller's face slipped away.
Maybe you better leave that out, too.
She paused the recording.
I won't print anything that makes trouble for you, Okello. I'm just curious.
What's the story with Kellaway? Okello met her stare with a sudden chill in his own Mississippi-colored eyes.
Old Nazi bastard put a gun on my neck on my 3rd day of work.
What? Mr. Boston, the floor manager at Booster Game. He asked if I could use my car to run some merch down to Daytona Beach. I was doing a bunch of errands because I didn't have my uniform yet. tugging at the silly gold basketball shirt that bore the words, "Booster Game," and showed a black hand gripping an orange ball of flame.
"I was out here sticking boxes in the back of my car when Kellaway sneaks up behind me and sticks the barrel of a gun against my neck. He says, 'Jail or the morgue? It's up to you. It's the same to me, either way.'"
"Bullshit," Lantern Glass said, although she believed him, and her tone said she believed him. Sarah's jaw was set, her mouth a grim line, and she was squeezing her boyfriend's fingers tightly. She'd heard this story already, Lantern Glass could tell.
"Hand on my heart,"
O'Keller said and tapped his fingers against his chest.
"He got on the radio, said he has someone lifting boxes off the loading dock behind Booster Game. Said I had a box cutter and a gun, too. But before his office radioed the cops, Mr. Boston saw what was happening and came running out to tell him it was all right, that I was an employee."
"You had a gun?"
"I had a tape gun," O'Keller said, "to seal a couple of boxes. The handle was jutting out the pocket of my hoodie. He was right on the box cutter, though. That was in the back of my pants."
The suspect rose, and I saw a flash in his hand. He leapt. I thought he was coming for me with a knife, and I fired my weapon to defend myself. That was what Officer Mooney had said when he was deposed before a grand jury. Lantern Glass had read the entire statement years later. All it took to turn a CD into a knife or a tape gun into a 45 was a little imagination, a little panic, and a lot of prejudice.
"You're lucky you didn't get shot," Lantern Glass said. "Why didn't he get fired?"
One corner of O'Keller's mouth turned up in that movie star grin of his, although there was a certain cynicism in it now that disheartened her. "Mr. Boston had the shakes for an hour. He was so pale he looked like he had the flu. He said he was going to call a complaint line for the firm that runs mall security, but when he tried, it was disconnected. He wrote them an email, and it bounced back as undeliverable. They're a big southern outfit, Falcon Security. They provide the men for a lot of shopping centers. You'd think it'd be easier to get in touch with them. Mr. Boston asked if I wanted to go to the cops and file a complaint, but I figured nothing would happen, so I said skip it."
"Why didn't you quit?"
"'Cause I can't pay for college with my good looks."
"Did Kellaway apologize?"
"Yep, on the scene, and then again the next day in his office. He gave me a $25 gift certificate good at any shop in the mall."
Holy shit. That was big of him. 25 whole dollars. What'd you spend it on?
"Still got it," O'Keller said. "I'm going to hold on to it until someone in the mall starts selling discount bulletproof vests. I'm in the market for one."
5:15 p.m. Lantern Glass watched the press conference on TV with Dorothy. Dorothy was on her knees in front of the television about a foot from the screen where she liked it best. 8-year-old black girl with a long neck and mile-long legs, wearing a hot pink cap with rabbit ears. She was going through a hat phase, had a drawer full of them. Getting her out of the house in the morning was a daily anguish. It could take her upward of 20 minutes to find the perfect hat for the day.
"I'm missing Kim Possible," Dorothy said, referring to her favorite Disney Channel series.
The local news had just cut to an unnamed conference room with the promise that the St. Vicente police were about to address the shooting at the Miracle Falls Mall, and perhaps identify the heroic security guard who had stopped the killer before the rampage could go wide.
"Mama's got to see this for work,"
Lantern Glass said from the kitchen table, where she was on her laptop banging out 2,000 words on the Ocala fire. It wasn't hard to get in the right mindset. She could smell the smoke right there in her living room, even with the blaze miles away. She wondered if the wind was shifting.
I want a job where I can watch TV and ride around in helicopters.
Next time you see Mr. Chen, you can ask if he's hiring. This household could use another source of income.
There wasn't going to be any bread coming from Dorothy's father. He'd been out of the picture almost since Dorothy was born. Wasn't going to let a baby fuck up his music career. Last Lantern Glass had heard, he was up in New York, in Queens, had two daughters by another woman, and his music career consisted of drumming on white plastic tubs in Times Square for dollars in the hat. Cameras flashed. There was a rustling like the wind stirring in leafy trees. The sound of an unseen audience murmuring and settling. Chief J. Rickles and the slim Cuban D.A. took seats behind a folding table arrayed with microphones. They were followed by a third man in a baggy hoodie that said SeaWorld and showed a jumping killer whale. The third man was in his 40s, guy with a graying mustache and a military haircut. He had the thick neck of a Marine or a boxer and big bony hands, and he regarded the cameras with oddly colorless, indifferent eyes. Chief J. Rickles waited for everyone to quiet down, and then waited some more, because he enjoyed a long, dramatic silence. Dorothy hopped a little closer to the TV.
"That's too close, Button," Lantern Glass said.
"I like to get right up next to the screen so I can see if anyone is lying.
Your hat is blocking my view."
Dorothy crept back an imperceptible centimeter.
"Hello and good evening," Rickles began. "I'm Chief J. Rickles, and I'm going to open with a brief statement summarizing the events of this morning at the Miracle Falls Mall. At approximately 10:30 a.m., a shooting occurred in Devotion Diamonds on the second floor. We have now positively identified the shooter as Rebecca Colbert, 20, of St. Percenti, who was a sales girl at the store. We believe that Ms. Colbert entered the store, where she shot Roger Lewis, 47, the manager of the Devotion Diamonds retail chain, Yasmin Haswar, a customer, and Yasmin's infant son, Ibrahim. At that point, Miss Colbert was confronted by Randall Kellaway, the head of security at the mall, an officer with Falcon Security, and a former military policeman in the U.S. Army. At this, Rickles leaned forward and aimed an admiring glance down the length of the table toward the big man in the hoodie. Mr. Kellaway instructed Ms. Colbert to put down her firearm. Instead, she raised her gun to fire, and at that point he shot her. Believing he had killed her, he hurried to Mrs. Haswar to offer medical aid. Another man, Robert Lutz, entered the store to try to offer his assistance, and he was shot by Ms. Colbert. At that point, Mr. Kellaway disarmed the shooter. Shortly afterwards, SWAT and emergency personnel swarmed the scene. Ms. Colbert was pronounced dead at 11:16 a.m. His hands were folded together in front of him. Rickles had the serene look of a man admiring a sunset while he sat on his porch with a can of beer. "Some of you are already aware that my daughter and her two children were in the mall at the time of the incident. There's no reason to believe they were ever in physical danger. There's also no reason to believe they weren't. Ms. Colbert was indiscriminate in claiming innocent life, and we cannot be certain what her final intentions might have been. Certainly, she was intent on killing to her last breath. I don't like to think what might have happened if Mr. Kellaway had not responded with such swift and decisive action. Have no doubt, this was an unspeakable tragedy. In the space of a few minutes, we lost a beloved local employer, an innocent bystander who'd entered the store in an act of fearless compassion, a mother and her infant. Her infant. A beautiful baby boy, who was part of St. Percenti's patriotic Muslim community. We'll be unpacking our anguish for days and weeks and months to come. But today we found out what happens when a bad guy with a gun meets a good guy with a gun. Today our grief is counterbalanced by our gratitude. Our pain abides alongside our pride."
He paused, leaned forward, looked at the assistant D.A.
"Mr. Lopez, would you care to add anything at this time?"
Why would anyone shoot a baby?
Dorothy asked.
Did that really happen?
Lantern Glass said,
That really happened, Button.
I think that's stupid.
Me too.
On the TV, Lopez leaned forward and said, The Flagler County District Attorney's Office has committed our entire resources, including 2 full-time investigators, to determine the motive behind today's heinous and tragic acts, and to learn whether Ms. Colbert acted alone or had the support of any Confederates. He spoke for another half a minute, reciting boilerplate. If anyone had any further information, blah, blah, no charges filed at this time, blah, blah, state-of-the-art forensics, yada, yada. Then he was done, and Rickles leaned forward again. Rand, would you like to make a statement? He asked, peering down the length of the table at the big man in the SeaWorld hoodie. A fresh round of camera flashes strafed the room. Kellaway sat with his hands in his lap and his head lowered, looking both haunted and a little hunted. He thought for a moment, then he shifted forward in his chair and leaned toward the microphone.
If my son is watching, I just want him to know Daddy's okay,
Kellaway said. The assembled crowd responded with a soft cooing sound that made Lantern Glass think of pigeons.
He's not that good a guy, Dorothy announced.
He stopped a crazy person with a gun.
But he also goes to SeaWorld,
Dorothy said, and pointed at his sweatshirt.
They keep orcas prisoner in little tanks. Like if someone stuck you in a closet and made you stay there all day. No one should go to SeaWorld.
Yeah, Jay Rickles said gently, almost quivering with pleasure. Daddy's okay. Daddy's okay, folks. Daddy's just fine. A final spasm of furious camera flashes filled the room. In their stammering, almost blinding light, Kellaway's very pale skin had a blue sheen, like gunmetal. 9:18 p.m. They were still out there, the news vans, the camera crews, choking the street in front of his house. He sat on the ottoman in the middle of his living room with the landline in his lap. The police had taken his cell phone. He could see the broadcast vans through a gap in the drapes pulled across the big picture window. CNN, Fox. His TV was on, the only light in the room, the volume turned off. They were playing that same clip of Jay Rickles saying his thing about the bad guy with a gun meeting the good guy with a gun. Kellaway felt like a bullet in a gun himself, felt charged and ready to go off, to fly toward some final, forceful impact. Loaded with the potential to blow a hole in what everyone thought they knew about him. When a gun went off, everyone turned their heads to look, and they would look at him now, too, at him, instead of past him or through him. He expected the phone to ring, and it did. He lifted the receiver to his ear. Holly's voice was breathless and small.
You're home. I wasn't sure you'd be home. I was just watching you on TV.
They recorded that hours ago. You're just seeing it now?
Yes, just seeing it now. You're all right? You aren't hurt?
No, love,
he said to his wife, still his wife, even now, on paper anyway. A little indrawn breath.
You shouldn't call me that.
Love?
Yes. You shouldn't even think it.
I would have been thinking it if she killed me. If she shot me today, it would have been my last thought.
Another shuddering breath. She was trying not to cry. She cried so easily, at the ends of TV movies about Christmas, at ASPCA commercials, when movie stars died. She was always clothed in the sheer velvet gown of her emotions, the fabric of it rippling with every step into the world she took, clinging to her wherever she went.
You shouldn't have gone in there. You should have waited for the police. What if she shot you? Your son needs a father, she told him.
Your lawyer didn't seem to think he does. Your lawyer thought it would be just fine if I only saw George once a month with a chaperone there to spy on me.
She took a sniffling breath, and he knew for sure she was crying now. It was several seconds before she could speak again, and then her voice was frail with emotion.
My lawyer didn't just push you around. She pushed me around, too. She threatened to quit if I tried to negotiate with you. She made me feel so stupid when I told her I knew you'd never hurt us, that you'd never...
Holly's sister squawked in the background, a harsh, unintelligible sound that reminded him of the adults talking in a Charlie Brown cartoon. Holly didn't know how to stand up for herself. The expectations of other people were like a blasting gale, and Holly just a sheet of newspaper, flapping this way and that under their influence. It was Rand Kellaway's opinion that Holly's sister Frances was a closet lesbian, and that the man she was married to was, in all likelihood, a queer. The dude wore bright shirts in suspicious colors, tangerine, teal, and enthusiastically watched figure skating on television.
"What's Frances saying to you?"
Kellaway asked. He felt something flare inside of him like a stroked match hissing into flame. But Holly wasn't listening to him anymore. She was listening to her sister. Holly said,
"Yes."
More squawking,
"No."
And then again,
"No."
In a pleading, whining tone.
"Tell her to mind her own business," Kellaway said.
He could feel Holly slipping away out of reach, and it maddened him.
"Don't listen to her. Whatever she's saying doesn't matter."
Holly turned her attention back to him, but her voice was flustered, hitching with emotion.
"George wants to speak with you, Rand. I'm going to put him on. Fran says I can't talk to you anymore."
When they had lived together, it had been one of Kellaway's rules that Holly could talk to Francis only when he was in the room, for exactly this reason. He had not wanted Holly to have a cell phone because of the danger of Francis texting her. He had refused to let Holly buy one, but then the fucking company she worked for gave her one, insisted she carry one.
"You tell that hairy cunt,"
he began, but then the phone clattered and it was George.
"Daddy?"
George said. He had his mother's rushing, breathless, excitable voice, the same soft, sweet slur.
"Daddy, you were on TV."
"I know,"
he said. It took a great effort of will to steady his voice and inject some warmth into it.
"I was in TV land all afternoon, where all the TV people live. The hardest part is getting there. They have to shrink you down very, very small so you can fit inside the television set."
George giggled. The sound of it was so lovely it made Kellaway ache. He wanted to hold his son in his lap and squeeze him until he shouted and tried to wriggle free. He wanted to take George to the beach and shoot bottles for him. George would clutch his fists and dance every time a bottle smashed. Kellaway would smash the world to see George dance.
"That isn't true," George said.
"It is. First they make you very, very small. And then you get a ticket and ride to TV land on Thomas, the tank engine. I sat right next to one of the Teletubbies on the trip."
"No, you didn't."
"I did, really."
"Which one?"
"The yellow one. He smells like mustard."
George giggled again.
"Mom says you saved people from dying. She says there was a bad person and you shot her down just like pow. Is that what happened?"
"That's what happened. Just like that."
"Okay, that's good. I'm glad you shot that bad person."
The squawking sounds began in the background, Fran getting going again. George listened to her, then said,
"I've got to eat my Eggo and go to bed."
"You do. Go on now. I love you, George."
"I love you, too."
"Put your mom back on.
Aunt Fran wants to talk to you."
Before he could reply, the phone clattered again, then someone new was on the other end of the line. Even her breathing was unpleasant, thin and slow and deliberate. "Hey, Randy," said Francis.
You got a court order not to talk to my sister.
She called me, he said patiently. There's no court order says I can't answer my own phone.
That same court order says you can't own a gun.
The gun, he said, was behind the counter at the Vietnamese restaurant in the food court, and I asked for it. It was Mr. Nguyen's gun. And the cops are keeping that part out in the news, not to protect me, but to protect him. He's here on a visa, and owning that gun could get him in hot water with immigration. But go ahead, make a fuss. Force the police to deport a guy who gave me the weapon I needed to stop a mass shooting. What a hero you'll be. I want to talk to my wife.
He had thought this lie through carefully, and felt it was beyond Francis's limited powers to assault. And he was right. She didn't even try. Instead, she went for the easier attack. She's not your wife anymore.
She is until I see the divorce papers.
Francis inhaled. He could picture her perfectly, the slits of her nostrils narrowing at the end of that long, bent nose of hers. She had Holly's features, subtly distorted so that she was utterly lacking any of Holly's beauty. Holly had a soft, pliant mouth, and eyes that shimmered with emotion and an innate desire to please. Francis's eyes were dull and tired, and she had deep creases bracketing her lips. Holly hugged easily.
No one would want a hug from Francis. The steely points of her hard little tits would probably leave bruises.
Maybe you think you can use this somehow to get them back, Francis said. But it's not happening. She's not coming back, and neither is he. Not after what you did to them.
What I did today, he told her, is save lives. What I did today is shoot a mad woman before she could go on a killing spree.
You'll have to shoot another mad woman before you get anywhere near either of them, because you'll have to kill me to take them away.
Well, he said to her, that would definitely be a bonus, wouldn't it?
He hung up. He didn't expect her to call back, but the phone shuddered in his hand a moment later, before he even had time to let go of the receiver. Francis couldn't stand letting someone else have the last word.
Why don't you rest your tongue, he said, for eating pussy later.
There was an awkward silence on the other end of the line. Then a young man said, Mr. Kellaway? My name is Stanley Roth. I'm a producer with Telling Stories on NBC. Well, it has not been easy to get your number. This is Randall Kellaway, yes? It took him a moment to recalibrate.
I watch your show. You did that one about the watermelons full of meth in Orange County.
Yes, yes, we did. Definitely our greatest claim to fame. Meth Watermelon is also the name of our office softball team. We beat the guys from 2020 to win our league last summer, and I'm hoping to beat them again in this weekend's ratings. I'm sure they're trying to get in touch with you to invite you on their show and talk about what happened today. I would be a very happy man if I were fortunate enough to get to you first. Stanley Roth spoke in such an exuberant flurry that Kellaway needed to go back over it in his head to figure out the guy was making an offer.
You want me to come on your show?
Yes, sir, we do. To tell your story. The story of the good man with the gun. You're Clint Eastwood, only for real.
Clint Eastwood is real, isn't he?
Yeah, well, yeah. But he gets paid to pretend to be what you actually are. Someone who knows how to fight back. People feel so powerless most of the time, so overwhelmed by the forces lined up against them. They need these stories like they need food and drink, stories about people who made the best, bravest choices when it would have been easier to fold, and who made a fucking difference. I hope you'll excuse my language, sir, but I get really amped up about this stuff.
Would I have to go to New York?
No. You do it from there. We can get a local studio and tape the interview remotely.
If it helps to nudge you in the right direction, I should add that Chief J. Rickles has already agreed to talk with us as well, and would join you in front of the camera. That guy loves you. I think he wants to adopt you, or marry you to one of his daughters, or maybe marry you himself. He talks about you in exactly the same awestruck way my son talks about Batman.
Maybe you ought to stick with him. He seems like he knows what he's doing when he talks to the press. I'm not a public speaker. I've never been on TV.
You don't have to be a public speaker. You just have to be yourself. Nothing to it. As long as you don't think about the 3 million people watching and hanging on your every word, which has still got to be less scary than running into a shop where a woman is killing people indiscriminately.
It wasn't scary. There wasn't time to be scared. I just ducked down and got moving.
Perfect. Oh, my God. That's perfect. Get ready to duck again, because women are going to be throwing their panties at you.
I'm married, he said with a certain edge, and I have a little boy, an amazing 6-year-old.
There was a respectful pause, then Stan said, did you think you'd ever see him again?
Not really.
Kellaway said,
but I'm still here. I'm still here, and I'm never going to let him go.
They were another 20 minutes on the line doing what Stan called the pre-interview, and the producer filling him in on what the on-air discussion would be like. They would record on the afternoon of the 10th and air it that evening. If you snooze, it ain't news, Stan said several times. Stan gave him some advice for looking good on camera, but it all washed over Kellaway without registering. When he hung up, the only thing he could remember was Stan's forceful directive not to eat blackberries, because the seeds would get between his teeth and make him look like a guy who never flossed. Once again, the phone rang almost as soon as he hung up. He thought it would be Stan again calling with some last urgent overlooked piece of trivia. Or maybe it would be someone from ABC or NBC, hoping to book an interview for one of their shows. But it wasn't Stan at all, and it wasn't CNN, and it wasn't Francis. It was Jim Hurst. The call was grainy with hiss, and his voice sounded far away, as if he were calling from the other side of the world, or maybe the other side of the moon.
Look who got famous today,
Jim said, and issued a dry, hacking cough.
More like look who got lucky, Kellaway replied. I figured if someone was going to blow my head off, it would be over in the suck, not here at the mall. Yeah, well, sound like some crazy bitch shot for trouble at the wrong place today. Got more than she paid for, huh?
He coughed again. Kellaway thought he was a little drunk.
You having some of the scotch I gave you?
Kellaway asked.
Yeah. I might have had a sip or two. I raise the glass to you, my brother. I am so glad you're alive and she's dead and not the other way around. I want to put my arms around you, man. If she killed you, it would have killed me, you know?
Kellaway was unaccustomed to strong emotion, and the prickling in his own eyes took him by surprise.
I wish I was worth half of what you think I'm worth.
He shut his eyes, but only for a moment. When he shut his eyes, he saw the woman, Yasmin Haswar, rising up from behind the glass counter, her eyes wide and frightened, and he turned and shot her all over again, straight through the baby strapped to her chest.
Don't get down on yourself. Don't you do it. You fucking saved a whole mess of lives today, and you made me proud. You made me glad for once that I survived and came home. I'll tell you what, man. It was never my childhood dream to live for 50 or 60 years as a useless drain on society. Today, though, I've been thinking, I guess I'm not a complete waste. When my best friend, Rand Kellaway, needed a gun, well, you weren't empty-handed today, and that's my piece of this. That's my little taste of glory. That's right. You had my back this afternoon. Even if no one will ever know it. Even if no one will ever know it, Jim repeated. Are you okay? You sound sick.
Ah, it's the fucking smoke.
It's right on top of the house tonight. It's burning my eyes, man. They say the fire is still 2 miles off, but I can't hardly see to the end of the hall.
You should go to bed.
Soon, man. Soon. I want to stay up and watch the news loop around one more time. That way I can toast you again.
Put Mary on. I'm going to make her send you to bed. I don't need another toast. I need you to take care of yourself. Get Mary.
And Jim's voice changed, became suddenly morose and querulous.
I can't, man. She's not here.
Well, where is she?
Beats the fuck out of me,
Jim Hurst said.
I'm sure I'll see her again, sooner or later. All her stuff's here.
And he laughed, until it turned into the broken, hacking, rattling cough of a man, choking on blood in his deathbed.
July 8, 8:51 a.m.
Lantern Glass reached out to the Lutz family first. When you had a bad job to do, it was best to do it first thing and get it out of the way. She hated calling the family of the deceased. It made her feel like a crow pulling strands of gut out of roadkill. The Lutz family was unlisted, but Bob Lutz, who died at just 23, had offered one-on-one piano lessons to kids at Bush Elementary, according to the school website. As it happened, the vice principal at Bush was a Brian Lutz. Lantern Glass called his office number and got a recording saying that he would be checking messages throughout the summer session, but if it was urgent, he could be reached at his cell, followed by the number. She made the call on the sidewalk in front of a Starbucks just down the street from Pacenti Pride Playground, where Dorothy had tennis camp. Lantern Glass had an iced coffee that was so cold, she broke out in goosebumps when she had her first sip. She was almost too nervous to drink it, didn't need the caffeine to amp her up. There was no reason to think Brian Lutz would answer his cell, but he did, on the second ring, as somehow she had known he would. Lantern Glass introduced herself in a quiet, gentle voice, said she was with the St. Pacenti Digest, and asked how he was doing. He had a deep baritone with a very slight crack running through it.
My little brother got shot in the face 2 days ago, so I guess not so hot. How are you?
She didn't reply to that. Instead, she told him she was so sorry that she hated to intrude when he was struggling with his grief.
But here you are, intruding anyway, he said and laughed.
Lantern Glass wanted to tell him about Coulson. She wanted to tell him she understood that she had been on the other end of this herself. In the days after Coulson died, journalists parked in front of the two-family house Aisha lived in with her mother and waited for them to come out. When Aisha's mother, Grace, walked her to school in the morning, the reporters would flock around them, waving tape recorders. Grace gripped Aisha's hand and stared straight ahead, and the only reply she ever made was a sound. That noise seemed to mean, I don't see you, and I don't hear you, and my daughter doesn't either. Lantern Glass knew now that her mother had been sick with fright, was afraid of the attention, afraid to be looked at too closely. Grace had been to jail 3 times, had in fact been pregnant with Aisha on her second stint in county, and was scared the reporters would publish something that would get her sent back. Aisha herself wanted everyone to know what had really happened. She thought they should tell all the reporters how Coulson was shot to death and he didn't even do anything, except take a stupid CD. She wanted to explain how Coulson was supposed to go to London and meet Jane Seymour and be in Hamlet. She wanted everyone in the world to know.
Ain't it enough you lost him? Grace had told her. You want to lose me, too? You want me to get locked up again? You think the police won't come down on us? We try to make them look bad?
In the end, Aisha Lantern Glass did get to tell the world all about it. She just had to wait 15 years. The St. Pacenti Digest had published Coulson's story in 5 parts over a single week. Those stories had been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize in local reporting, which was why Lantern Glass still had a job when almost all the other full-time reporters with the Digest had been laid off in the recession. But she didn't tell Brian Lutz about Coulson because she had promised herself a long time ago that she'd never use his death as a way to get a story. Even